Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a subject that, well, it often gets framed in terms of, you know, moral duty or scientific urgency.
Right.
But maybe not often enough through the lens of economics, specifically environmental economics.
Mm.
We're digging into the framework laid out by Stephen Smith.
Yeah, and our mission today is pretty clear, I think. It's about shifting perspective. Mm. Stop seeing environmental protection as like a roadblock to growth,
mm-hmm.
and start seeing it maybe as an outcome of just smarter economic policy. Smith's core idea is that these environmental problems, air quality, climate change, you name it, they aren't separate from the economy.
Yeah.
They are fundamentally economic problems. They stem from failures within the economic system itself.
That framing, that really changes things, doesn't it? Instead of this constant battle, you know, economy versus environment. Smith says the real question is just, how do we get the prices right? Why is that simple question so critical right now?
Well, think about the scale of the climate crisis.
Yeah.
Smith calls it, and this is quite a statement, the greatest market failure in human history.
Wow. Okay.
And what that means fundamentally isn't a failure of, say, technology or even political will necessarily. It's a failure of measurement.
Measurement.
Yeah. The system has just completely failed to attach a real cost, a real price, to dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
Right. It's treated as free?
It's treated as free. And if we can fix that broken price signal, then we could unleash the market, which, you know, is an incredibly powerful problem-solving engine, to actually tackle it.
Okay, so let's talk about the person behind this pragmatic view. Who is Stephen Smith? Why should we listen to his perspective on this?
Stephen Smith is, well, he's a major figure in this field, professor of environmental economics at University College London, PhD from Cambridge, so serious academic credentials.
Right.
But what makes him stand out, I think, is his deep background in public finance.
Ah.
Okay, that's interesting. So not just theory.
Not just theory at all. He's got extensive real-world policy experience. He's worked with the UK Treasury, the European Commission, the OECD. These are the places where policy actually gets made.
So he knows how the machinery of government works, how things actually get implemented.
Precisely. That background means he's less focused on, you know, super abstract economic models and much more on the practical stuff, the nuts and bolts of designing policies that actually work.
Like a carbon tax or a trading scheme.
Exactly. How do you make those things efficient? How do you implement them successfully? He bridges that gap between the academic theory and, you know, the reality of the government budget office.
Got it. Okay, so let's get to the core idea then. Smith argues that environmental problems stick around because traditional economics has this fundamental flaw. It treats the environment as a, quote, free good.
Yeah, and that's a starting point for, well, a lot of the trouble. If something critical, clean air, a stable climate, biodiversity is treated as free,
then economic actors, rationally, will use it up without limit. Zero cost basically means infinite demand until it's gone or broken.
And this leads us straight to the concept you mentioned earlier, market failure. Specifically, the idea of a negative externality.
Right. A negative externality. It's essentially when the cost of something spills over onto people who had nothing to do with the original transaction.
Yep.
Pollution is the classic example.
Yeah.
A factory makes widgets, sells them, makes a profit. But the cost of the dirty air, the health problems in the community, downwind, the cleanup.
Those costs are external to the factory's balance sheet.
Exactly. They're pushed onto society. The social costs are way higher than the private costs the factory actually pays.
So in effect, we're giving the polluter a kind of hidden subsidy.
That's a great way to put it, a hidden subsidy. And because the product seems cheaper than it really is, the market produces too much of it. And too much pollution along with it.
Okay.
So the goal of environmental economics, Smith argues, is to get rid of that hidden subsidy. Use economic tools to internalize the externality.
Make the polluter pay the true cost.
Make the polluter face the true social cost. And when that happens, suddenly their self-interest aligns with what's good for society.
It sounds elegant, almost simple. Make the price tell the truth.
Yeah.
But this feels like the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
How on earth do you put a price tag on a healthy forest or, you know, a stable climate? Isn't that inherently arbitrary? Seems impossible.
It's definitely the critical challenge, no question. And it's a fair point. But Smith's counterargument is pretty stark. If we don't try to value the environment, even imperfectly,
yeah,
then in the practical world of policy decisions, its value automatically becomes zero.
Oof.
And a value of zero basically guarantees it gets destroyed. So valuation, even with all its difficulties, is absolutely necessary if we want to make rational choices.
Okay, I see the necessity. So how do economists actually try to do this? How do they move away from that dangerous default of zero?
Smith outlines two main approaches. First, there are what we call revealed preference methods.
Revealed preference.
Meaning, we try to figure out the value by looking at people's actual behavior in related markets. What they do, not just what they say.
Can you give an example? Something concrete?
Sure. The classic one is hedonic pricing. You look at, say, house prices. You take two houses, basically identical in the same city, but one is near a park with clean air and the other is near a smelly factory. The difference in what people are willing to pay for those houses.
That difference reveals something about how much they value the clean air.
Exactly. Their actions in the housing market reveal their preference and the value they place on that environmental amenity.
Okay, that makes sense for things linked to property. But
yeah.
What about, I don't know, saving a rare species of frog in the Amazon that I'll never see? There's no related market for that.
Good point. And that's where the second category comes in. Stated preference methods.
Stated preference. So this is asking people directly.
Pretty much. It relies on carefully designed surveys, often using a technique called contingent valuation. You essentially ask people hypothetical questions.
Like what?
Like, how much would you personally be willing to pay in extra taxes each year to guarantee the survival of this specific endangered species? Or what would you pay to prevent an oil spill in a certain area, even if you derive no direct use from it?
That feels tricky. People might say one thing in a survey, maybe to sound good, but act differently when the actual bill arrives.
Absolutely. It's controversial. It's prone to biases, strategic bias, hypothetical bias, you name it. But it's often the only way we have to try and measure what economists call non-use value or existence value.
The value we place on just knowing something exists, even if we don't use it.
Exactly. And Smith would argue, again, you have to try and measure. Otherwise, in policy debates, it just gets ignored. Treated as zero.
Right. So once we have some idea of the value, or at least the cost of the damage, then we need the tools to actually make the change.
Mm-hmm.
So this draws a big contrast between the old way, command and control regulations, and the more modern market-based instruments, or MBIs.
Yes. Command and control, CNC, that's the traditional approach. Think of the government saying every factory must install this specific type of pollution filter.
Or every new car model must achieve exactly this miles per gallon standard.
Right. It dictates the how. Very specific mandates.
But economists, especially environmental economists like Smith, tend to argue CNC is often inefficient. Why is that?
Because it's inflexible. It's a blunt instrument. It applies the same rule to everyone, regardless of how much it costs them to comply.
Okay.
So imagine you have company A, maybe they're newer. They can cut their pollution by 90% for, say, $50,000. But company B, with older tech, might have to spend $5 million to achieve that same 90% reduction.
Right.
A CNC rule forces both to do it, even though it's vastly more expensive for company B. It doesn't achieve the overall environmental goal at the lowest possible cost to the economy as a whole.
And that's where the market-based approaches, the MBIs, come in. Smith really focuses on two main types. Let's start with the simpler one, the environmental tax, sometimes called the Pigouvian tax.
Right, the Pigouvian tax, named after Arthur Pigou. It's beautifully simple in concept. You just put a direct price on the pollution itself.
Like a carbon tax.
Yeah.
So much per ton of CO2 emitted.
Exactly. You tax the bad activity, and the beauty is it gives firms total flexibility on how to respond.
How so?
Well, they have a choice. They can just pay the tax. Or they can invest in cleaner technology, change their processes, find ways to reduce their emissions below the level where the tax bites hard.
And they'll choose whichever option is cheaper for them.
Always. They'll find the lowest cost way to reduce pollution. So the tax incentivizes innovation and ensures the environmental target is met efficiently at the minimum overall economic cost.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second major MBI, the other big tool in the kit?
That's the tradable permit system, which most people know as cap and trade.
Right, cap and trade. Heard a lot about that. More complex.
A bit more complex to set up, yeah, but potentially even more powerful in some ways. It sort of flips the logic of the tax.
Does it work?
Okay, so the government first decides on the total acceptable level of pollution. That's the cap. Let's say 1 million tons of sulfur dioxide per year.
Okay, a hard limit.
A hard limit. Then the government issues permits or allowances corresponding to that total amount. maybe 1 million permits, each allowing 1 ton of emission.
And gives them out or auctions them to the polluting companies?
Usually auctions them or sometimes allocates them based on history, though auctioning is generally preferred economically. Now, here's the key part. Companies can trade these permits amongst themselves.
Ah, the trade part.
Right. So remember Company A, who could cut pollution cheaply?
Yeah, for $50.
If they reduce their pollution way below the number of permits they hold, they have extras. They can sell those surplus permits on the open market to Company B.
Company B, for whom cutting pollution was really expensive.
Exactly. It's cheaper for Company B to buy permits from Company A than to install that $5 million technology.
So Company A makes a profit from cleaning up more, and Company B complies at a lower cost than under command and control.
Precisely. The market finds the cheapest overall way to meet the cap. The incentive is always there to reduce your own pollution because you can then sell your unused permits for cash.
And is there a big success story for this?
Oh, yeah. The textbook example is the U.S. Sulfur Dioxide SO2 trading program set up back in the 1990s to tackle acid rain.
Acid rain, right. I remember that.
It was incredibly successful. It reduced SO2 emissions much faster and far more cheaply than anyone had predicted, certainly much cheaper than the old CNC approach would have been.
Right.
It really proved the concept works in practice on a large scale.
That's genuinely powerful. Mm. Okay, let's zoom out a bit. If someone listening takes away just 3 core messages from Stephen Smith's framework, what should they be?
Okay, 3 key takeaways. First, I'd say efficiency over ideology.
Meaning
we should favor these market-based approaches not because they fit some political ideology about free markets, but because the evidence shows they're just more cost-effective.
Right.
They get the environmental job done at a lower overall cost to society. And, crucially, they provide ongoing incentives for companies to innovate and find even cheaper ways to clean up. CNC rules tend to lock in technology and get outdated.
Good point. Okay, what's number 2?
Number 2 addresses that constant political fight. The idea that helping the environment hurts the economy. Smith's work shows sustainability is compatible with prosperity.
Ah, the jobs versus environment myth.
Exactly. Well-designed environmental policy, especially policies that price pollution correctly, actually stimulates the economy. It forces innovation, creates demand for new clean technologies, new industries, sometimes called the Porter hypothesis.
So protecting the environment isn't a burden. It's actually necessary for long-term economic health.
Absolutely. Because unchecked environmental damage, think climate change impacts, like floods, droughts, sea level rise. That's the real long-term economic burden. Action is a form of risk management.
Okay, crucial point. And the 3rd takeaway.
The 3rd one is a dose of realism. Policy design matters enormously.
Ah, the devil's in the details.
Completely. It's not enough to just say, let's have a carbon tax or let's do cap and trade. Success or failure often rides on the specifics.
Like what kind of specifics?
How high do you set the tax? How do you initially allocate the permits in cap and trade? Do you give them away or auction them? What do you do with the revenue raised from a tax or auction?
Right.
Look at the European Union's emissions trading system, the ETS. In its early phases, they gave out too many free permits they overallocated.
And the price of permits crashed.
Exactly. The price signal basically disappeared for a while. It shows how even a good idea can stumble if the detailed design and the institutional context aren't handled really carefully.
That's a vital lesson.
Yeah.
Now, Smith has a way of framing these ideas that really sticks. Let's highlight a few of those core concepts or memorable lines. The first one directly tackles the cost question.
Yeah, he puts it beautifully. The question is not whether we can afford to protect the environment, but whether we can afford not to.
That flips the whole script.
It really does. It forces you to think about the cost of inaction, the cost of dealing with climate disasters, health impacts, resource depletion. Those are real economic costs happening right now. Environmental protection isn't a luxury. It's essential risk management.
And another one that boils down the core problem.
He states it very plainly. Markets fail spectacularly when environmental damages remain unpriced.
Simple, direct.
It just hammers home that central point. The market isn't inherently the enemy. It's a powerful tool that's currently operating with incomplete, misleading information because pollution is treated as free. Price the damage, and the market will start driving solutions.
And my personal favorite, because it tackles the political challenge head-on, is the idea of environmental taxes being a potential tax swap.
Ah, yes. This is crucial for making these policies politically feasible. The idea isn't necessarily to increase the overall tax burden on the economy.
Right.
Instead, you use the revenue from taxing pollution a bad to reduce taxes on goods like income or payroll or corporate profits.
So you shift the tax burden away from things we want more of, like work and investment.
And onto things we want less of, like pollution and resource depletion.
So it could potentially be revenue neutral. The government collects the same total tax, but the incentives are dramatically changed.
That's the ideal, yes. Make work pay more. Make pollution cost more. It reframes the policy from just another tax grab to a smarter way of structuring the entire tax system. A potential win-win.
These aren't just abstract economic ideas, though. How does understanding this framework help us, you know, in our daily lives or in our jobs?
Well, on a personal level, just grasping the concept of externalities changes how you might see your own choices.
Like driving versus taking the train.
Exactly. Or understanding why things like plastic bags might have a small charge. It's not just punitive, it's trying, however imperfectly, to make the price reflect the environmental cost. Or think about congestion charges in cities.
Right, not just a cash grab, but an attempt to make drivers pay for the delays and pollution they impose on everyone else.
Precisely. It helps you evaluate policies more clearly, too. You can start to distinguish between policies that are genuinely trying to fix a market failure efficiently and those that might be more symbolic or less effective.
And what about in a professional context? For people in business.
Oh, it's absolutely essential there. If you're in any kind of business, understanding the logic of carbon pricing, resource scarcity, environmental risk, it's becoming core business strategy.
How so?
It helps you anticipate where regulations are heading, manage risks, but also, crucially, identify opportunities.
Opportunities.
Huge opportunities in energy efficiency, in developing cleaner technologies, in circular economy models. Companies that understand these economic drivers and see environmental performance not just as a compliance cost, but as a market signal.
They gain a competitive advantage.
A massive strategic advantage, especially as we transition towards a lower carbon economy. It's moving from defense to offense.
So wrapping up, what was the biggest takeaway or maybe surprise for you revisiting Smith's work?
For me, it's just the persistent power of getting the incentives right. It sounds simple, but it's profound. And it offers a surprisingly optimistic path.
Optimistic how?
Because it suggests these huge environmental challenges aren't necessarily intractable moral dilemmas requiring universal sacrifice. They are, in large part, problems of incorrect pricing.
Problems that economic tools can actually help solve.
Exactly. It moves the conversation away from just conflict and towards finding pragmatic, efficient, potentially win-win solutions. If we can get the economics right, we can make real progress.
Yeah, I agree. The core insight feels like environmental damage isn't some inevitable tragedy of modern life. It's a flaw in the system, a bug in the code that we actually know how to fix, theoretically.
Right. And that puts the pressure squarely on execution. Can we design and implement these policies effectively? The economics gives us the blueprint.
So the future really hinges on mastering those details, the specific tax levels, the permit allocations, the revenue recycling, getting that policy machinery working correctly.
That seems to be the challenge. Environmental economics isn't just a niche subfield anymore. Smith's work shows it's become absolutely essential for managing any modern economy sustainably.
A pragmatic, essential perspective. A great place to leave it. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.